Wild courage exists to galvanize a generation of men. The tools and courage to fight for what matters most. And tell the stories that are born in the redemption of lives and souls.
Today on the Wild Courage podcast, I have the honor of introducing you guys to my friend, my brother, and my neighbor down the street, Mike Fallon. Thanks for getting up early and coming down here this morning, brother.
Heck yeah, man. Wouldn't miss it for the world.
Yeah, so Mike and I's story goes back probably 16. I was at your wedding, so 16 years.
16 years. Yeah. Oh, the first time I met you was down for my wedding.
Yeah. And then since then, we've moved to Idaho, and Mike and Becca and their family also moved to Idaho. And so we're kind of related, but we also really do life together.
Yeah, definitely.
And have worked together and fought rattlesnakes together. I was thinking this morning when I woke up, like how cool it'll be. I'm going to put the video on the Wild Courage Facebook page of you popping a rattlesnake's head off like a whip.
There you go.
That kind of, in a nutshell, like sums up the kind of bravery that you have.
I don't know if that was bravery or just stupidity.
Or boredom. So we've spent a lot of time in West Texas working together.
Yeah.
And in our industry and what we do. Mm-hmm. There's lots of, it's perfect rattlesnake habitat. Yep. So there's tons of rattlesnakes in the ponds that we remove the liner out of.
My first day on the job, I was with Mike Evenson, and that was when I got a taste of the rattlesnakes. He ran over a pile of them, and there was about six that just came out of the woodwork and terrified him to death. Oh yeah, it was good times.
Yeah. So I think I'll put that video up on our Facebook page so that people can see.
That'll be a good one.
Yeah. You grab them by the tail and whip them around and snap their head until it breaks.
Yeah.
But how many rattlesnakes do you think you killed down there?
Man, dozens.
Yeah.
Dozens and big ones, big as my arm.
Yeah. There's some big, gnarly dudes down there.
Yeah.
The good thing, it was usually like in the morning when we'd find them, so they were pretty slow.
Yep, pretty docile.
Yeah, but so again, our story goes back together like 16 years, like we said, and about how long ago did you guys, we've been here 8 years, when did you guys move to Idaho?
We've been up here, it'll actually be 7 years, the 21st of this month, September.
Oh, yeah. So Mike and Becca, and they're... At the time,
three kids
moved into our back spare bedroom.
That's right.
Mike was working nights at Costco in early mornings.
Mm-hmm.
And Becca and the three kids and Mike all lived in this tiny little bedroom in the back of our house.
Yeah. And we all shared one bathroom.
That's my favorite part.
And in order to get to that bathroom, we had to walk through your master bedroom.
So we took family like to a whole new level.
We did.
And that was for how? Like
9 months.
9 months.
We lived with you guys for 9 months till we found our house.
Yeah. And that's when we really got to obviously know each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And spent a lot of time staying up late.
Going and getting tasty treats.
Yeah. Right before Albertsons would close at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Which is super healthy.
It was good times. Yeah.
But that's kind of when the four of us, me and you and Mary and Becca started like really sharing story with each other and kind of going into the deep, darker places of our pain and brokenness and really learning to be vulnerable and share with each other. And
I don't know
that if you guys wouldn't have lived with us for 9 months, if we would have got to where we got to.
Yeah. I don't know if we would have either. It was really good for me. It was really good to spend time with my sister.
Mm-hmm.
Cause growing up, we really weren't that close. And so to live in her house,
get to really know her,
really got to know her really well. And then she's really good at asking questions too. So we'd talk a lot and Becca and her became really close. It was a special time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of grace on that season. Cause most families don't survive that. But we survived it and survived it well.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of factors. Like, I was gone a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't as probably healthy then as I am now emotionally.
Right.
And yeah, there was a ton of grace because it was a lot. I mean, I put myself in your guys' shoes, especially Becca, like, okay, I'd like to take a shower, but, you know, I got to make sure that nobody's in the bedroom. And
yeah,
it was just a lot of opportunity for awkwardness.
For sure.
And a lot of opportunity for people to walk in on each other.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. So that was pretty
Luckily,
cool.
Luckily, there was none of that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just cool to really get to spend that time with that season with each other and get to know each other. And I think that's where you and I probably started really trusting each other enough to go the places we did. I remember, you remember this? Like in that season, I think you had just moved into your house.
Okay.
And you're like, hey, I'd like to tell you my story.
Mm-hmm.
And we grabbed some lawn chairs and went over to the lake.
Oh yeah. I'll never forget that.
And
for sure.
Sat down. And that was before I even told you my story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when you told me your story. And I remember wanting to jump in and tell you my story.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the first time I had enough self-awareness to be like, I didn't have any of the language for it, but like, I'm not going to come over the top with my story,
right?
With his story, like, getting to like be sad for you and with you and like have compassion for you and what you've been through in your childhood.
Mm.
But then also thinking this brings us even that much closer together.
Yeah.
And I think it was a while later before.
It was a while later. Yeah.
Before I even shared my story with you.
Mm-hmm. And you shared your story bits and pieces over years.
Yeah, but not ever
the full thing until just, you know, last couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing that what you have the capacity to share at the time, but
and even then, you know, that was probably 6 years ago at the park. I shared minuscule part of my story.
Yeah.
You know, it was all I really knew.
And I think that there typically has to be some level of healing sometimes before you can go to the deeper places. And that's kind of where you and I are at now of experiencing some healing in these super broken areas of our life and addiction and pain and figuring out where this trauma started and the ramifications of the trauma.
Yeah.
And understanding that, like, gosh dang, when we are vulnerable and tell our story, how many other dudes can identify with what we've been through? Mm. Like, I just look at my like tier one group of friends that have been affected by sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And these are all dudes, masculine, like not inner city kids, like just grew up on farms, ranches. Mm. You grew up in the city, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
So your experience is a little different, but it's just blows my mind that, again, out of like my top tier group of friends. And the more I've shared my story of sexual abuse, the more I can't believe the amount of people that have like,
it's insane.
Can I tell you something? Like, and just, it's so humbling to have people tell me that you're the first person I've ever told, but some of the things you've talked about that's happened to me. It's just been an eye opener that this is something that I think is a bigger deal than anybody knows, because there's no statistics to back up how many men have been affected by sexual abuse. Right.
Yeah.
Because men aren't talking about it.
Yeah. Cause it's surrounded by shame.
Yeah.
It's surrounded by shame. I mean, it, you asked me to do this podcast, what?
Six, 7 months ago.
And there was no way in hell I was going to do it because I was still living in so much shame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that journey of you getting rid of shame to be here today, it was kind of cool whenever I asked you just the other day if you would be on this, and you were like, hell yeah, I'm ready.
Let's do it.
But that's a testament to what, which is what I'd kind of like to talk about a little bit today, is that journey you've been on even in the last 6 months to get to a place of like, I'm ready to share my story from a place of healing.
Totally. And not from a place of shame or of just, I'm still in this dark place. And yeah, it is definitely from a place of healing. I mean, there's still so much more healing to go, but I can talk about it from a place of healing. And there's some stuff I'll talk about, but there's just been a few things just in the last few months that have really set me free to be able to just relax and see the big picture. I'm almost seeing my life from the Lord's eyes, which is so key in these situations. Cause we get so stuck in the moments or in the moments of trauma where the shame exists and we get stuck there and we can't see outside of it. And so the Lord's really been able to show me kind of the outside, the big picture of the whole thing. And
yeah, it's awesome.
It's been able to,
well, and just your walk with God through your whole life of is another powerful.
Yeah. And even that's drastically changed.
Yeah.
I've over just the last couple of years.
Yeah. Seen it go from all these different places of, from anger and frustration and, to understanding more and like this God that isn't anything, doesn't look anything like you probably thought he did when you were a pastor.
Yeah.
That's just, that's a whole nother part of your story. Like, which is
cool.
Like we're going to have Mike on a whole bunch in the podcast because he just has been through so much. And I feel like you offer so much encouragement to guys that have been through the same stuff that you've, you know, kind of walked through and fought for and not given up on and dealt with so much shame. And, but so you were raised, to jump back into your story a little bit, in Southern California, San Bernardino, Redlands.
Yeah.
And, have two older sisters. So you're the little brother.
Yeah. Little brother.
And you were a exemplary rock star in school, right? Like straight A's?
Straight A-F's. F's. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny. We talk about my story and my story was always, if I was going to give my story growing up in the church, it was like, you're going to give your testimony, right? Like how you became a Christian.
Yeah.
And my story was always, I was always kind of ashamed of it because I never had any, like, I was caught by the cops and I shot some dude and went to prison and met the Lord in jail. My story was like, well, I was 5 years old and I got in trouble at school. My parents told me about Jesus and I accepted Christ. Right. And that's
and then like, I went to church every day.
Yeah, I went to church every day, became a pastor and, you know, struggled here and there. And that was it. And like, that was my story. And who can relate to that? Like nobody can really relate to that. You know, it's just nonsense. And so, man, I go back to kind of my real story and, you know, I grew up in a Christian home. I had amazing parents.
Amazing.
Amazing. Who were saved themselves. I struggled through school, like you wouldn't believe. Well, I mean, you would believe, but I hated it. I was just awful at it. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I couldn't just do anything. And,
so it was shaming.
It was every single day. Yeah, it was a shaming experience.
It sucks to be the kid at school that's struggles for sure.
Yeah. I remember, and this kind of plays into a lot of the pain and trauma that led to a lot of my addictions was, I remember going to school and sitting in class and, being so desperately scared to be called on, I would shake and tremble and then I'd get called on and then my voice would crack and the kids would laugh. And those little moments, they seem insignificant, but they compound over time. And it's just trauma after trauma after trauma. And then you believe, you begin to believe those lies like, oh man, I am stupid. And those become an ontological statement, ontological statement, meaning an I am statement. I am dumb. I am stupid. And so all through high school, all through college of, you know, a few weeks that I went, I believed that I was dumb and stupid. And while there was another side of me that was very articulate and could speak well and you know, all those things, there was a certain side of me that I believed I was dumb and wouldn't amount to really anything, that I had to do a certain job because if I tried to do anything else, my intellect couldn't take me there. So,
well, and subconsciously that plays out until literally recently in your life.
Yeah.
It's to some degree, right?
Absolutely. I didn't really understand the degree of how intelligent I was until just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Until I was like 40. I'm 41 now. So yeah, 39, 40, I was like, you know what?
I can't figure yourself
out. I am not stupid.
Yeah.
I am not dumb. So to believe that essentially your entire life is super debilitating, and it keeps you from who you were created to be, for sure.
Yeah. But you early on in life found an outlet that I think is probably worth talking about, because it's such a big part of your life. But
yeah, when I was about 12, I had a next door neighbor that was in martial arts, and man, I loved this guy. He was a few years older than me, and he was a black belt in martial arts, and I just idolized him. I thought he was just the coolest kid around, right? And so I got into martial arts and ended up doing super well in martial arts, got a black belt. And by the time I was 18, I opened my own studio, and, it was just one of those things that was just an outlet for me to kind of, instead of doing drugs, I fought.
Do you feel like, looking back now, like it was an outlet for the academic failures you were feeling, like, well, at least I'm good at this, right? It was like self-validating.
Yeah, that's such a great point. It absolutely was. Because everywhere else in my life, I was a failure. Everywhere. I mean, everywhere. I felt like a failure at home. Because I was
school
kind of
was
just,
such an issue.
School was such an issue. I felt like a failure at school. And so to be involved in this martial arts that I was so good at and achieved, you know, excellence at, better than everybody, and was praised by the instructor. So being called out at school as kind of the dumb kid, to this complete opposite, being praised as the greatest, you know, in the studio, is kind of just this. I held on to that tight.
Yeah, I was going to say, did your reputation, did that start following you at school, though, as a badass?
Totally. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So then it was super validating, right? So you're really going to dive into that, because it kind of covers up the, well, he's not the smart kid in the class, but you can't say anything and laugh now because he will kick your ass.
Yeah, and totally. And I was never the guy that portrayed that. Like,
no,
I was a very nice guy, and I loved all my friends, but it was kind of one of those little things that just kind of traveled around school, like, oh yeah, don't mess with Mike. And I never said it, but it was just like,
your reputation preceded you. So you didn't ever have to flex.
Didn't have to. Yeah.
Because
one time. Yeah.
When somebody else is saying that dude's a badass, don't mess with them, it's the best publicity you're ever going to get.
True statement.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's not coming from you. So it's humble.
Right.
And you're just
right.
walking around like in plain, ordinary clothes. It's not like you're wearing your black belt to school.
Yeah.
And so girls are starting to be like, oh, hey, that dude's a badass. Like,
yeah.
And cool and nice and never brags about himself.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have to.
It never really became my identity as much as it should have. It never really became my identity because I still believed I was dumb more than I believed I was.
Interesting.
I was excellent at martial arts or excellent at something else. So at school, I was just the fun, flirtatious, guy to be around, but you don't cheat off my paper, you know?
Yeah.
So that was my identity. My identity was I'm the fun, let's go have a good time. I'll be there for you if you need me, the nice guy. But also the kind of the class clown, and also the guy that's just, you know, probably not going to make too much of himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you were started martial arts, like it became like, that's what you did, right? Like that was your outlet for
absolutely
probably the school stuff and the other like things that came later. But that was really what you gave yourself.
I fully gave myself to it. I trained 6 days a week, every single day, several hours a day. By the time I was 16, I had a key to the gym, and I'd ride my bike there and open it up, and I'd train and train and train.
And you started to teach at that point too, right?
Oh yeah. I was teaching adults by the time I was 16. I was teaching adult classes with cops in it, and they'd come and train, and I'd teach them all kinds of different things. And, it was just one of those things that I excelled at quickly. And then the instructor of that studio at the time took me under his wing.
Your protege.
Totally his protege. And I essentially, by the time I was 16, I was running the entire school. And then he left left about time I was 18. And then 18, I rent when I'm still in high school and went and opened my own studio and had that till I was about 21. And then from there, I quit that. And then that's when I got into MMA and realized that everything I learned prior to that was useless. Funny story. I'll tell this real quick. But, you know, in Taekwondo, it's, you know, I ended up getting a 4th-degree black belt. And I, in my mind, thought I was a badass. I'm like, dude, look what's around my waist. It's black and it's got 4 red stripes. What's up? So I remember kind of wanting to transition into MMA because UFC was getting popular. I was like, oh, that looks, I bet I'd beat everybody in that. Right. So I started this local gym and, training for a little bit. And so I get in the cage with this one guy and I was like, hey man, how you doing? How long you been training? Oh, about 6 months. And I'm like, dude, I'm going to beat your ass. I've been training for like 20 years. So anyway, we start fighting and I'm poking him real good, right? Kicking him and doing well. And all of a sudden this guy drops to the ground and picks me up and throws me on my back. I'm like, what the hell? Like, what is this? And he starts wailing on me, like just body, body, head, body, body, head. And I finally just tap out because I don't even know what to do. And I get up, I'm like, oh wow, that was humbling. Everything that I've learned just got thrown right out the window when I'm on my back. And so, yeah, from there I started doing MMA and that's, I love that. So,
well, and the cool thing to jump forward to, what did you do last night?
Last night I did some jujitsu. I took about 12 years off and last night I signed up again to jujitsu and I'm a white belt again, man. So it's fun. It's really good.
I just think it's beautiful that your humility in, as this progresses, because most guys would never, to get to a 3rd-degree black belt in any discipline, they're never leaving that.
Yeah.
Right? You
yeah.
work too hard to get there. Mm-hmm. So your humility to be like, I'm going to try this and then get your ass kicked and then stick with it.
Yeah.
And then at 41,
right,
after a little pep talk from your sister.
Yeah, totally.
Is like, no, there's a new gym in town and I'm going to go submit myself to something I don't know a lot about.
Yeah.
So I think it's super humbling of you to do that and inspiring that you aren't, it's never too late to learn something new.
Yeah.
But it really just comes down to pride, right? Like being like, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing and it's okay. I want to learn. So,
you know, it's funny though. I had to, there was a period about 12 years where I took some time off. And it wasn't because I wanted to, it was almost as if I needed to, because like you said, I used martial arts to cope with a lot of things.
It was a front.
It was a front. And I had no idea that it was, I had no idea. And over the last 12 years, God has shown me, okay, what did you use this for? And what are you hiding from? And of course that brings me back to my childhood and brings me back to, okay, now I know what I use this for. Now I know why I needed martial arts. I needed to submerge myself in something so that I didn't have to think about everything else. So, yeah, I think, So going back to my story, simply enough, again, I was 5 and I remember my parents, talking to me about God and thought, all right, yeah, I want to be a Christian. Sure. So accepted Christ. And that was kind of how you become a Christian. Right. And moving forward, there was so much just simple, and I don't want to say simple, but there was simple trauma of me being left at school alone. I remember so many times, my mom dropping me off at school and me not getting out of the car. I would not get out of the car because I was so terrified of going to school and being laughed at or bullied, whatever it was, that she'd call my dad at work. My dad would have to come back and drive all the way over to the school and get me out of the car and leave me. And it just always made me feel just abandoned, right? And as a young kid, feeling abandoned is traumatizing. It makes you feel like nobody wants you, you're alone, no one understands you. And so those beliefs begin to compound over time. And then, you know, that's how I was for years. And then going back to, this is such an ironic story, but going back to my neighbor who was the martial artist who I adored and
my hero,
right? I wanted to be just like him. And because I wanted this, man, this sounds so odd talking about it now, but it's the way it is. But because I wanted to be like him so much, I wanted him to like me. I would let him do whatever he wanted to me. And I mean that in a sense of he would sexually abuse me all the time for years. And he would do some pretty awful stuff. And so that started me down a road of just tremendous amounts of shame that I didn't even, you don't know what shame is when you're that young, but it solidifies in your spirit and in your soul and to your very being that you are, you're gross, you're disgusting, and no one will ever understand what you're going through. I remember the first time I went over there, one of the first times I went over there and he's like, hey man, check this out. My uncle left this tape. And I was like, what are you talking about? And so he puts this VHS tape in the player and turns it on. And I remember the name of it was called Hot Oven. And he turns it on and it's a porn. And it's the first time I've ever seen anything like that. And I remember feeling so, man, maybe conflicted is the right word, right? There was a part of me that was so utterly disgusted that I wanted to throw up. But there was this other side of me that was very curious. Like, what are they doing? Like, ugh. So I remember feeling just so super disgusted and I kind of made an excuse like, hey, I'm going to go outside and do something else. But it's those little moments that really solidify something in a child. Right. And then
how old were you?
I think I was around 10 or 11.
And the abuse was happening at the same.
Correct. Yeah. This was the beginning of it right here. That was the moment where it started. He got kind of sucked into it and
you just want to be,
I just wanted
accepted
to
by accept this it, guy. Yeah.
And which to me, that's where a lot of the shame stemmed from, especially after, you know, years and years, years later. Like, dude, why didn't you just walk away? Or like realizing that I wanted to be accepted so much that I allowed somebody to do that to me.
Again, it took over
a
and
lot
over.
Of healing. Right. Took a lot of healing.
Yeah. Like, cause it's like once is like, okay. Yeah. But then what inside of me is so broken that I subject myself to it again and again. And then the lie you believe of like, well, for me and my stuff, I was like, at some level, I must have not hated it because I kept subjecting myself to it.
Or,
which is really shameful.
Yeah. And for me too, it's like, how pathetic are you that you can't just walk away? How pathetic are you that you'll let someone do that just because you want to be liked by them? Right. So anyway, upon that too, I used to find dirty magazines in the back of our house. We had a flood control area. And there was always dirty magazines back there. And so I'd grab them and look at them. And, again, the shame would come and I'd hide them under my bed and just all the things that kind of little boys go through. But the problem was, is there was no one there to tell me that it was okay. And no one there to tell me, to walk me through the process of it's okay. Let's talk about it and help you figure out that this is normal, that it's not something you need to be shamed about. And just walk me through the process of how damaging it is, as well as healing me from it. and saving me from it. There was no one there to save me. There was, and I think that was one of the hardest parts is now that I've been kind of going through the healing process is realizing that I was alone through the entire thing. No one saved me. No one came to protect me, which in turn you kind of take the face of that and you put it on the face of God, right?
Yeah, there's a bigger pattern.
There's a huge pattern
to that. I just see this like from your dad having to come get you and leave you at school.
Yeah.
So there's like fear and abandonment there. Mm-hmm. Then your neighbor, who's your hero, and you want to be best friends with, and he lets you down in the worst of ways.
Yeah.
And then not even counting your instructor guy that took you under his wing and what he did. Like, there's no way that your view of God is going to make it out of this alive.
Yeah, you know, you grow up in a church environment and you're told that God is love and God will take care of you and protect you, but you can't reconcile that with what you experience in life, right? Like if God is this all loving protector
who's in control,
right? Why are all these bad things happening to me? Why has he not protected me? Why didn't he protect me then? So all these things, right? But yet you want to believe that he is good and that he is going to protect you, but yet he never does.
But life experiences
shows complete opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of moving forward, kind of getting into my teenage years, I remember my parents getting a computer for the first time, internet, you know, back in the day. And that's when I kind of started dabbling in porn. And that was just a long, probably 25 years of porn addiction for me, all the way into my marriage, halfway into our marriage. I was fully addicted to porn. And, you know, going from this church kid who loved the Lord and always desperately wanted to know him and to experience him and to be good for him, to please him, right? Like those are the things you want to do. Like I want to please him. I want to be good for him. I want to know him. But yet there's this dark side of me that is fully engulfed in this addiction of porn and fully engulfed in this shame and feeling gross and worthless and trash because of what I let people do to me. And it's just, you really can understand you live two lives. There's two lives. There's this life of
secret one.
Yeah. There's this life of just secrecy and shame. And then there's this life that everybody sees. That's just this guy who loves the Lord
and shiny, happy people,
Happy people. But they're both real. Like the shiny, happy person is not fake. Like he is real. That was the real me. But just broken, just shattered, essentially.
How did you navigate, like, because you probably were active in your youth group and like that probably just, I know for me, compiled the shame of like, because I grew up in church also.
Yeah.
And just that feeling of like, if anybody ever finds out. Right. Like the gig's up.
Yeah.
Like even like we're hiding something from God. Right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, if he's going to be so disappointed if he finds out what I'm up to.
Yeah. So crazy. Yeah. Again, it's that two different lives. But yeah, I was totally involved in my youth group. I remember my youth pastor would just say, man, there's an anointing on you. There's something powerful upon you. And I believed him. It's just these, and I would pursue it. I'd pursue all the things of God, yet I'd still pursue every night wanting to look at porn and masturbate. I mean, I was all about that. Like that was my release. But yet the shame would come every night and I'd pray and do all the Christianese things like, oh God, I'm so sorry. Thank you that you love me still. And you know, all the things that we learn, but we don't really understand or believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then to kind of move forward in my story a little bit,
But in the meantime, like, you're like, you're Mr. Outside Adventure, yeah. like rock climber, mountaineer. Mm-hmm. Like, you every would take a backpack sport. And yeah. go in the wilderness by yourself for 10 days. Like, that's...
Yeah, for sure.
That's, like, your ideal vacation is yeah. you yeah. by yourself mm-hmm. in the wilderness, climbing a mountain.
Absolutely. That's one of my favorite things to do is to go hiking, rock climbing. And I really enjoy doing it by myself. One of my best friends, Jeremy, after high school, we became real close, and he was my buddy that we used to do everything together. And then he went into the military and left, and so I didn't have anybody to go do that stuff with. And there aren't too many people around that just want to go hiking for days or climbing. And so I started just doing a lot by myself, and I learned to really love solitude. I learned to really love just being by myself. And there part of that, I think, was... I don't have to be authentic with anybody. I don't have to go deep with anybody. I can just go be myself, and not think about anything and just be alone. I really found a lot of peace in being alone.
Do you think that it was the chance of getting exposed by anything when you're alone is that it's not going to happen, right?
Yeah. I think that's a great point. Yeah. I think there's part of it that I just felt so much shame and so broken that I didn't want to really be around anybody. I didn't really want ever anybody to ask me deep questions. But again, this is all subconscious. I can look back at now and kind of understand why, but then I just thought I liked being alone.
Yeah.
But now I understand I wanted to be alone because I did not want to
be seen.
I did not want to be seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very true. I just did not want to be seen, truly seen or known.
So into your, after high school, you're still doing martial arts mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and, you know, spending time in the wilderness. At yeah. one point, didn't you move to Truckee or to?
Yeah, I moved, when I was kind of my mid twenties, I think I was around 23. I moved to Reno. I just wanted to get out of California. I moved to Reno because I wanted to be a police officer up in Truckee where my other sister lives and her husband. So I moved up there. I was there for 6 months. Never did anything with the police academy or anything like that. I just worked at Costco up there.
Which is where you were working pretty much after high school?
Costco. Yeah, yeah. Correct. Yeah. I started at Costco in 1999 and worked there for 18 years. So, yeah. So in that time, I moved to Reno to work at Costco and hopefully get in the police academy, which never happened.
Just think if you would have gotten the police academy, you could have been like Russ and retired right now.
Oh, that'd be sweet. Yeah.
Come on.
Of course, Russ. I am pretty retired right now. I'm not going to lie.
You took a shortcut.
I did. Yeah. So we're skipping a lot, but I just kind of want to get to some things that I think are pertinent. So anyway, the whole time I'm, you know, in high school, all through high school, all through my 20s, in Reno, fully addicted to porn, fully addicted.
Dating through this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Dating chicks here and there.
But Christian, so there's the purity.
Totally Christians. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sex was bad, so yeah. I wouldn't have sex, but I do everything else, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's
okay.
That makes sense. I had several pretty serious girlfriends, all while, you know, being addicted to porn and things like that. But I remember when I was, kind of in my 20s, I was so done with being addicted to it. Right. I just wanted to stop. I wanted to be good. I wanted to please the Lord. And I would beg God to take this addiction from me. I remember one time I was in Reno in my little apartment on the Truckee River, and I'm sitting there journaling, and I'm journaling like, I want to look at porn right now, and I don't know what to do. Why can't I stop? And I remember just going through the motions of like, God, please, please don't let me go to the video store and rent a movie. Like, please don't let me, as I'm getting up and getting my keys, sitting in the parking lot, God, please don't let me go inside as I'm opening the door to go inside. Please don't let me get this movie as I get the movie. And that was just kind of my, that was kind of my MO for the next several years. It was like, God, please just don't let me do this as I'm doing it. Yeah, right.
I know that.
And kind of being frustrated with the Lord, like, why? Like, why aren't you taking this from me? And you hear story after story of like, oh, I prayed one time and God took my addiction of drugs or porn or alcohol, whatever it was. And here God is like abandoning me and to my shame. And it's just, it again proves my belief about myself that I'm not worthy to be saved. I'm not worthy to be helped. God loves me, but doesn't really care about me. Mm-hmm. So it's all those things that we learn in church. Like God loves you, but does he like you? Is he fond of you?
Yeah.
And I knew that God loved me, but I didn't think he really cared about me. Cause if he did, he'd help me.
Or, and all these things wouldn't have happened.
And all these things wouldn't happen for sure. So yeah, I remember just years and years would just go by of just begging. And then I finally, after 6 months in Reno, I came home, which is kind of where I met Becca, my wife. And we started dating and going to this church. And I remember again, I'm just desperate to be free. And I do all the Christian stuff. Like if you confess your sins one to another, God is faithful to forgive you. So I would confess to my pastor, or to my friends, like, guys, I'm struggling. Like, help me.
When do you remember the first time you ever went to your pastor to, how nervous were you then?
Yeah, I was very nervous.
And how was that received? Do you remember?
I honestly don't remember. And the reason why I don't remember his reaction, because I said it in a way that made it seem like I was healing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was past tense.
It was past tense-ish.
Yeah.
Correct. So there really wasn't anything for him to say. Because it was more of like, hey, I want you to know that I've been struggling, but I'm doing well. Mm. I'm doing good.
Yeah, it was a half-truth.
Exactly. And so he would say, oh, good job, man. Proud of you. Right?
Yeah. And that felt a little bit off the hook.
Exactly.
Of the shame exactly. and the guilt.
Yeah,
and the,
yeah. I remember even prior to this, I was dating a girl and I confessed to her because I just, the guilt and the shame was so bad. Yeah. I confessed to her and I remember she was really, really upset. And she's like, you need to confess to everybody. Like, you need to tell everybody what's going on. So I was like, all right. So I remember I went and told my parents. I told my best friends, like, hey, I'm really struggling with porn.
That's some balls to do that.
Dude, it was rough.
Dang.
It was rough. And so, but for me, the logic behind it was like, the Bible says that if I confess, God will heal me. That's what I believed. Yet every time I confessed, 3 days, 6 months, didn't matter how long, I'm right back in it. Right back in it. And that would happen for years. And then, of course, then I get married and I think as most people do, especially men in the church who grew up in the church, they believe that if I get married, it'll go away because then I can have sex and sex is what I need. And once I get to have sex, then the addiction goes away. And that is a lie from the pit of hell.
That didn't happen?
Did not happen. It did not happen. So yeah, I get married and I think, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to have sex all the time. And I'm not going to need...
All the fantasies will be fulfilled.
All the fantasies are going to be filled and it's going to be wonderful. Well, that didn't happen. We didn't have sex at all, really. And that's a whole nother story we can talk about sometime. But so it drove me deeper into shame. And then the logic behind it is, well, if I can't have sex with my wife, I might as well masturbate. And in order to masturbate, sometimes I got to look at porn. And
it so justified.
And then the shame would come and all the things, right? And so... we got involved in church and once again, my, pastor of the church really took me under his wing and saw an anointing and sure enough, like I get ordained as a pastor and there's the two sides of me, right? The one side is like, oh man, I love the Lord. I'm a pastor. I love this stuff. And then there's the other side. The secret side is like, just going home and masturbating and looking at porn, this secret life that no one knows about, no one. And there was a couple times through the beginning of our marriage that I would tell Becca, like, hey, I'm really struggling. Like, I looked at porn last night, and she never understood how bad it was, because I would never say how bad it was.
What was her reaction when you tell her?
The first couple times, I'd be so broken about it. Like, the shame and the guilt would just come out. And so I'd be weeping and crying and, you know, I'm so sorry. And so she'd be like, it's okay. Like,
she'd have compassion.
She'd have compassion. Yeah. And so, you know, then years would go by and she would think I'm fine, and nope. So one of the hardest times was, the church that we were a part of, where I was ordained, kind of went separate ways. I started a different church with another pastor, and this is where I really started wanting to know the Lord. Like, I wanted to know Him, and not only know Him, but I wanted to experience Him. I've heard all these stories of, like, people being baptized in the Holy Spirit and having these great experiences, and I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to experience Him. And so I remember this one time I'm about to preach on Acts chapter 2, and, I'm reading it, and the Holy Spirit comes, and they're all speaking in tongues. And I'm just like, I don't know any of this. I've never experienced any of this. What is this? And so it took us on this journey of trying to find out what it means to be baptized in the Holy Spirit. Right. So for the next 2 or 3 years, I'm preaching in front of this church while every night before I'm looking at porn and masturbating, and the shame of that. Like, I remember counseling guys on porn addiction, like the amount of hypocrisy I was feeling, man. And just like, and every time it would just wedge this lie of you're a piece of shit.
You're beyond hope.
Yeah. You are beyond hope. You, like, you're never, ever going to get rid of this. And again, just begging for the Lord, and the Lord would never show up. And it was just the theme in my life. The Lord would never show up when I asked him to.
Again, I just see this pattern of, like, your dad having to rip you out of the car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your neighbor, who's your hero, yeah, and what he did to you.
Yeah.
Then your martial arts instructor yeah, who didn't, I mean, that's probably, yeah, the short version of that story.
Yeah, he didn't sexually abuse me, but real quick, I was dating a girl who was a couple years younger than me, who turned out to be a raging alcoholic. And so I went to him and asked him to help.
Because you really cared about her.
I cared about her a lot. And so he, in his kind of manipulative way, would tell me he was helping her, yet he would go get her drunk, take her to hotels, and rape her. And then I found out a couple years later, and man, that crushed me. Cause that man was everything to me. I mean, everything. He built me into this awesome fighting machine, and, taught me about the world and about life and all these things. And just that crushed me. That crushed me. So yeah, there's that theme of these people that I kind of glean to and hold on to and want to be like, and they destroy me.
I'm let you down. And let me down. You mentioned it earlier, but I think you and I have been on this kind of journey together a little bit of, you really, what we do as humans, we take all of our experiences in life with men, mm-hmm, that have any power or authority,
yeah,
over us. And we put them all together, and we put all those faces over the face of God.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
And that's why I just, as you were started talking, I was just seeing this pattern of the men that hurt you, let, mm-hmm, you down, didn't, mm-hmm, show up for you,
yeah,
abandoned you,
mm-hmm,
caused so much pain that turns into trauma,
yeah,
that keeps us in these broken cycles of addiction, whatever it is. For you, it was porn.
Yeah.
But it really turns into whatever it turns into, right? For, yeah, me, it was alcohol.
Yeah.
But then it's impossible to reconcile. Like,
mm-hmm,
God's for you and loves you and all the things we hear.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you look to Him, and all you see is these men,
yeah,
who've done all these things to you.
And all of those things are subconscious.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't know it until you go on. Yeah,
the logical side of me always believed what I learned in church. That was the logical, my brain. But my heart believed that he's a that he is an angry God who does not love me and does not care about me and is not for me. That is what I truly believed, but you don't know what you don't know. Because logically, in my head, I've always learned that God loves me. So God must love me. So if God loves me, then all of this must be my fault. All of it. I'm the one that's
a heavy load.
Yeah, it's a heavy load. So anyway, back to my, kind of my marriage. We, you know, I was a pastor of this church. The hypocrisy, the shame was awful. And I look back on that time and I thank God that it went the way it did, because both Beck and I just felt like the grace was over for that church and we decided to leave. And it could have gone many different ways. It could have gone where Becca could have found out and I would have had to tell the church or
exposed, yeah.
Totally exposed. And it didn't happen that way. Luckily we just kind of left, and which was about the time we decided to kind of make the run up here to Idaho. And right before we were about a year before we were going to move to Idaho, I'm still fully addicted and just so fed up with it. Finally, I decide like, okay, I've got to do something. And so I remember going online and looking for something that could help me. And I found this, this website called Setting the Captives Free. And it was a website to deal with sexual addiction. And, so it was this 60-day, internet course that you email somebody and you go through this course. And I come home one day and I'm like 7 days into it, and every day they'd email you back or whatever. And so I come home and I could tell something was wrong, because Becca didn't get up to look at me. And she goes, "Have you been looking at porn again?" And like, you know, your heart, like it just
leaps,
it leaps, you know, you've been found out. And I was like, "Yeah." And she goes, "Get the fuck out." I remember I didn't even say anything and I just turned around and walked out. And man, I just remember feeling like my life's done. I'm over. Like, I'm done. I am done. I remember I got my truck, or actually I remember I went and got a bunch of camping stuff. And I was thinking like, all right, I'm just going to go live in the wilderness. She at the time was, pregnant with my third son, Asher. So we had two older kids, Paxton, Cambria, and Asher, and she was pregnant with Asher. And I remember just going up into the mountains and just praying like, "God, please do something." But probably he's not gonna, you know what I mean? And I remember she would text me and she'd be like, "I want to know everything. Tell me everything." And I decided that I was going to tell her everything. And one of the hardest ones was, I'm trying to think timeline. Sorry. One of the hardest ones, she was like, were you looking at porn during this specific time? And it had to do with our son who wasn't born yet. And I had to say yes. And I remember I just didn't want to say yes on the text. And I was like, I gotta say yes. And I said yes, and that crushed her. Like it was just devastating to her. And so anyway, I slept in the mountains on the side of the road for, I think, 3 days. And I didn't know what to do. And so finally I'm driving home from the mountain and my phone's about to die. And I text her and I was like, "Hey, I need to, I know you don't want to talk. I know it's over. But my phone's about to die. I just want to come home and get my charger." And she said, "I don't care what you do. Just do whatever you want." And so I remember I come home and, I sit down on the couch and I just start weeping. And I don't know what she asked me or if she said anything, but I just remember I said, "I've been through a lot and, this has nothing to do with you. that I think I just told her, I said, when I was little, I was molested by my neighbor. And I think that was the first time I told her. And I just said, this porn addiction started when I was a kid. It has nothing to do with you. And I remember that's kind of all I said. And she just said, I don't care what you do. You can go, you can leave. I don't care anymore. Mm. And so I decided to stay, and I slept in our spare bedroom. And, I think, within about 2 weeks, I remember she kind of came in and, she just said, I'm conflicted. She's like, I hate you. But I feel so sorry. I feel so sorry for the little boy. And I think that's kind of where she kind of let it go for a little bit. And we kind of looked past it for a little while. And then a year later, kind of from that moment, we moved to Idaho. And I struggled with it for a little bit here in Idaho. But I would say I've been clean for the last 7 years. There's been little lapses here or there, but the beautiful or the hard thing was, is for me, I always tried to fix the porn addiction. It was always about the porn addiction. Like, I've got to stop looking at porn. So I'd set parameters on my phone or whatever. And then even after, you know, Becca and she found out, I went to counseling, and the counselor would say, well, you know, you have to change up your life a little bit. You gotta, you know, what happens is you go home and you get triggered by the way things look and all these things. So I don't even know how to explain what he was saying. It was worthless. But anyway, it was just a bunch of stupid stuff. So anyway, like, I tried all these things and, you know, nothing helped. Like, it just, I could not stop the addiction to porn because I was going after the porn addiction and not about, I wasn't going after the root of the porn.
Yeah. And I like how I've heard you say it before, and identified with it, with me and my addiction was, I could white knuckle it for a month or two and
for,
like,
sure,
in my own willpower, like, not drink.
Yeah.
And even sprinkle some scripture on top of it, mm-hmm, to help me, like, motivate me.
Mm-hmm.
But like you're saying, until you go deal with the source of the pain, some people call it the demons, right? Like,
right.
Why do I do the things I do that have nothing to do with how it's manifesting?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you just don't know. You think you have a porn addiction, so you go after porn addiction. So you go after all the, you know, the logical things. Okay, if I'm addicted to porn, then I need to throw away my computer. I need to throw away my phone. And that does zero good. It doesn't do anything. And even if I got rid of everything that I could possibly look at, my pain would manifest in something else.
Yeah, it would attach to the next.
It would attach to the next thing, whether it would be control or alcohol or drugs or whatever, because pain. And I didn't realize that I was in pain until just maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I'm listening to a podcast by William Paul Young. And for some reason, he's got a very similar story. And he says something about, they ask him, how did you deal with your addiction? And he said, I dealt with my pain. And he said, I had no idea that I was in so much pain. But when I finally realized that pain was the source of my pornography addiction, that changed everything. And I remember he said that, and it finally clicked. It finally clicked. I'm addicted to porn because I'm in pain.
Mm, come on, dude.
Right? And that was a life-changing moment for me. Yeah, that was a life-changing moment. And then asking God, what am I in pain over? Because at this point in my life, I'm not thinking about being molested. I'm not thinking about all the times I've been abandoned and all the little seemingly insignificant moments in my life that have caused pain, that have compounded into this crazy addiction. And then all the shame on top of it, you know, every time you look at porn, shame is compounded and that drives you deeper into the addiction. So going after the addiction does no good unless you go after the shame and so then go good. After all the pain.
When you heard Paul say that, did you like, for me, when I had that same kind of aha moment, yeah. It was like the shame immediately started, like,
it because immediately it was like started lifting,
having compassion for yourself. Yeah. Like, I'm not a bad person. I'm not a piece of shit. I don't suck. I am worthy of, maybe I'm worthy of love, which is what, you know, maybe I'm worthy of being seen and heard.
Yeah.
And that's such a revelation of like, I'm not this thing that I've been telling myself for 20 years, which is you're horrible. If anybody finds out, you're done, right? It's the intimacy part of, I don't want connection with my wife.
Yeah.
Because I'm afraid if somebody really gets to know me, they'll find out how much I suck because of this. So to hear that, it's not the porn.
Yeah.
It's not the addiction. It's, there's a reason why.
Yeah.
And healing's possible.
Yeah. He said
it's so hope giving.
He said it like, he would say like, you don't have a porn problem. He'd look at someone who's addicted to porn and say, you don't have a porn problem. Why are you dealing with the porn? You have a pain problem.
Mm.
You have a pain problem. And that broke me. Like, I remember I was in my shop doing some woodworking and I broke. Like, I was on my knees weeping. And not out of sadness. It was out of this, finally, it was out of this just beautiful moment of, now I know why I've been addicted for so long, and I know why God didn't take it away from me. It's because I was holding on to the lie that I'm an awful, shitty person, and I was in pain. The reason why I was in porn and addicted to those things because I was coping for all the pain that I was in, and that was just a beautiful moment for me to realize I'm not addicted to porn. I'm using porn as an outlet because deep inside I am a shattered little boy who needs an outlet. And what I desperately wanted in my life as a young boy and a young man is someone to want me, someone to desire me, to someone to not hurt me, to someone to come and save me. And in a weird way, porn is that outlet. It's the fantasy of relationship, but without the risk, right? They can't reject me.
And they can't abandon me.
They can't hurt me. And so there's this weird dichotomy of even though it doesn't make sense, but it tickles that need that I needed. I needed someone to not abandon me to my shame. I needed someone not to abandon me at school or whatever it was. And so looking at porn and seeing these people desire me, and it doesn't make sense, but it does something internally that it fulfills that inner longing to be wanted. And even though I knew my parents wanted me and God wanted me and my friends wanted me, the what played out was they didn't want me. They wanted to leave me at school. They wanted to make fun of me. They wanted to molest me. And so this was that risk of relationship, but there was no risk because they can't reject me. They can't hurt me. They can't abandon me.
And it makes you feel...
makes me feel powerful
and in control. And when you've been through sexual abuse trauma, so much of life, and again, this is subconscious. This is stuff that, you know, we're learning even now is I need to be in a place where I'm in control.
Definitely.
Because then I can guard myself against anybody hurting me, right? So you really start shutting down emotionally and you keep things superficial through whatever the outlets are, but relationally, the risk is too great.
Yeah.
The risk is too great. That's why for you being alone in the wilderness, it was like, mm-hmm. there's some sense of like, I'm in control, nobody can hurt me, and I can actually be myself.
It's so good.
Without the risk of being exposed or somebody finding my phone or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's amazing to look back knowing what we know now and see, well, that's why we did the things we did, which so I know you'll agree with this, but what's so important as part of this healing journey that we've been on is to find a place where you can have compassion for yourself.
Yeah. Because the way out of shame is through compassion.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. And man, I'll tell you one of the things that have just helped me with that is, I was actually at a Wild Courage night and, someone asked a question. If you could go back 10 years, what would you tell yourself? And I think I've been asked that question before and thought about it, but I was just kind of thinking about that. And I was thinking, okay, 10 years ago, I was 31. I was in the midst of my addiction, desperately wanting to get out. Didn't like it, didn't want it, just, but stuck and knew that I was always going to be that way. I was never going to get out. And so I'm thinking about, okay, what would I tell that 31-year-old who's a pastor, who is on Saturday night praying to the Lord, give me a message for tomorrow. And I can't think straight because all I want to do is go look at porn and masturbate. And I know that unless I go do that, I'm not going to hear from the Lord.
Hmm.
And so I would go look at porn and I'd masturbate and I would feel relaxed. I'd feel fine. And then I'd be able to hear from the Lord. It's so weird. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But the shame and the hypocrisy that would come upon me was just, I mean, it's crushing. It's crushing, right? So I'm thinking about, man, what would I go tell him? And I'm thinking about all the things that I've learned over the last couple of years. And I, oh man, I want to go tell him, hey, it's not about porn. You're in so much pain, Mike. You're in so much pain. It's okay. And I realized like the 31-year-old Mike can't comprehend the things that I know now.
Mm.
And he can't comprehend it because he hasn't gone through it. He can't comprehend it because he hasn't had the experience that 41-year-old Mike has. And so I'm just thinking like, man, what would I want to do? And I just realized like, I can see 31-year-old Mike, but I also know what 41-year-old Mike is. So there's no need for me to go back and shame him to tell him stop doing it because I know how he's going to turn out in 10 years. I know how he turns out. He turns out good. He's not addicted to porn anymore. And he's learning to be free and he's learning to be okay. And he's learning to restore his relationships and all these things. So there's no need for me to go back and shame him or, you know, tell him all the Bible verses and tell him all the things. Like, I know how he turns out because I'm him.
So good.
So I realized like all I would want, man, this still hurts or just brings so much pain, but all I would want as that 31-year-old boy, man, is I would just go back and love him.
Mm.
And I would just go back and I would sit next to him in his pain. And I would sit right next to him in the midst of his disgusting, shameful acts. I would sit next to him as he masturbates. And as he's looking at porn. And I would just love him.
Tell him it's going to be okay.
I'd tell him it's going to be okay. Because it is. Here I am 10 years later and I'm okay.
Yep.
But the beautiful part about that is I realized that is what God had been doing with me my whole life. That God has never shamed me. He's never shamed me. He has been sitting next to me
in the midst of my shame, in the midst of my brokenness, and he's not upset. He's not sad. He's not disappointed. He's none of those things because he knows me. Like if you can imagine a timeline, right? At the beginning of my life to the end of my life, he knows it all. He knows me. He knows who I am. He's
outside of time.
He's outside. So just like I could go back 10 years and not feel any ill regard towards 30-year-old Mike, God looks at my life.
Oh, that's good.
And does not look at me as if he's disappointed. He's like, man, why did you do that again? Like he doesn't care. It's not about my actions. It's about my heart. It's always been about my heart. And he knows my heart because he created it, and he created it to be good. And my heart is good. So it's just this beautiful, freeing knowledge that God looks at me as a perfect, unblemished, beautiful, loving son, because he sees me for who I am and not for what I'm doing in the moment. And that has been a life-changing knowledge. And man, I hope the people who are listening can comprehend that, because a lot of people are in the midst of this addiction or a addiction, and God doesn't give a shit about your addiction. He cares about your heart, and he's sitting next to you in the midst of your pain, and he loves you, and it's going to be okay.
So good.
Yeah.
Yeah. The lie is that if God only, he knows what I've done, he can't be for me.
Yeah.
That's, I just remember too, in that space of just that shame of feeling like, well, he can't. I've broken all the rules. Yeah. I've broken all the religious rules.
Yeah.
And the system is set up to feel guilt and shame.
Yeah.
It really is.
I was grown up in a system that I was bound to fail.
Yeah.
I mean, there was nothing I could do but fail.
Or you can toe the line and shut down and not live at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which some people have seemed to pull that off.
Mm-hmm. I pulled it off well.
Yeah.
For years.
And it's just, it's amazing to me, your journey of seeing, even today, just hearing your story in such a vulnerable, authentic way of what's possible if you don't give up.
Yeah.
If you don't succumb to, like, I guess this is my lot in life, which is what I thought all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as I'm, you know, in my 30s and pushing into my late 30s of thinking, like, I guess this is just how my life's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be alone, and I'm probably going to be a drunk, and I'll have some friends around me because I'm fun to party with, and because I don't see any other way out of this thing because I can't stop.
Mm.
Right? It's that. I love what you said about, like, it's not the addiction. It's about going after the pain. And recently I've had conversations with people, and one guy, I'm like, I don't know that you should even go after your addiction.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's
go
it's,
after the pain first. Like some people, their addiction's going to hurt others. Like, get help.
Yeah.
If you need to white knuckle it till you can find some of these truths that we're talking about, white knuckling it.
Right.
If you're abusive, if you're like me, drinking and driving all over the country, literally, running from everything in your life, stop.
Yeah.
But this guy's addiction wasn't harming. I mean, it was harming his marriage.
Right.
But I was like, dude, I don't know that you should even quit. Go after the pain. That'll clear itself up. The point being that that's not the problem.
It's not. You don't have a porn addiction. You don't have an alcohol addiction. You have a pain problem.
Yeah. And I validated it. I'm like, dude, if I was you, I would be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
I literally, the pain that he's in, I'm like, I don't know that I'd stop if I was you. Like,
I know.
You're going to have to work some stuff out with your family dynamic. But,
yeah,
you know, because counselors, man, they're just like, program this, program out this, stop this. You got to get this stuff on your phone, or you got to get an AA. And
That's exactly what it was for me. I loved AA
like for that part of my journey. Like it was, it was tools. It was helpful. But again, man, it's really about going after the pain and understanding where it came from. And, and again, just having compassion for yourself. In your journey of trying to figure it out. And, and I remember when I did a podcast and told my story, on Justin's podcast, I wasn't going to listen to it cause it's so weird, you know, like listening to your own voice, obviously something I've had to overcome to do this. Right. But, I remember, Mary and Rob and a few of my close people telling me you need to listen to it. And I started listening to it on the couch. And once I started getting into my story, like literally I went in my bedroom, and the amount of compassion that I felt for me telling my story about the, that little boy was so healing. Like I laid in there for hours and just wept over what he went through. And it, and I say all that to say there is something so powerful about having compassion for yourself.
Absolutely.
In the midst of trying to figure it out, not knowing, like, I don't know what this looks like, but I'm going to have some compassion for myself, because you can't give away what you don't have. So I found having compassion for myself and starting to love myself, because so much of this shame turns into self-hatred, right? Like I hated myself for a decade. Like I didn't look in the mirror. Like I really, I hated shaving. Literally, I would grow a beard because I hated myself so much that I didn't want to look in the mirror long enough to shave.
I know that feeling.
So it, the antidote to that is going back in your story, those painful places, places that I blocked off for 35 years of my life that I would not allow myself. It's like, there's something familiar about my story, but I would never let it come up to the surface.
And of course,
and, but letting yourself go there in having compassion for yourself is the antidote to self-hatred. I'm convinced of it.
It is. It absolutely is. That's been one of the keys to my healing, is just having compassion on myself. And again, like you said, self-hatred, I mean, I hated myself as I'm a pastor preaching the word, talking to people.
The hypocrisy, I mean, can't get any worse than that.
It just can't. That's the top of the line right there. So yeah, I know about self-hatred, but now going back on my life and just having compassion on those moments and realizing like, it's not about the addiction. It has nothing to do with the addiction. Like you are, your innocence was completely ripped out of your life.
Stolen.
It was stolen from you. And when that happens, your body is in shock and is in pain, and that pain has to come out. It's just the way humans are wired. Pain has to come out, and it'll either come out in crying. It'll come out in, you know, in kids, it comes out in crying. But as you grow older, you subdue that pain and you squish it down, you push it down, and then you push it down so much that you don't even know it's there. But yet that pain still has to come out. And so it comes out in, you know,
all sorts of ways,
all sorts of controlling, anger, all
manipulation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And all the different ways we learn to self-protect. But for this pain to escape. And with, and the compassion part, it's so vital, because I found that I didn't have compassion for people in traffic. I didn't have compassion for my family. I didn't have compassion for my wife, for my kids, right? Like you're just always right there. Like you're always on the edge. And because you truly can't give away what you don't have. So
it's true,
I've found the more that I've had compassion for myself and my story and gotten more healing, that again, it's the opposite, right? Like in shame turns to self-hatred, compassion turns into self-love.
In a
good way.
Yes.
Not in a self-absorption, making it all about you, got to get mine way.
Yeah.
But like into a way that we were created to love ourselves, that we truly can love our neighbor. Like out of a place of my, me loving myself, I have more capacity to love my wife, my kids, my friends, even God.
Yes.
Even God,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So I don't know. I just think there's something powerful about understanding that shame turned into self-hatred and compassion can turn into self-love. Like, I feel like that's the antidote to some of these things. So I just would encourage anybody out there that identifies with any of the things that Mike talked about and we kind of went over to just start allowing yourself to think about what possibly could you be in pain over.
Yeah.
And here's the thing about trauma, right? Like, I was talking with somebody for a year, my brother Justin, and he was helping me identify that I had PTSD.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's only for soldiers.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not qualified to have that, right?
Yeah.
And he helped me walk through, the trauma that you experienced through your, molestations and all the sexual abuse and physical abuse and mental abuse, like that, that's showing up in every area of your life.
Absolutely.
And like understanding that. So I don't know, there's something about that even like that allowed me to start having compassion for myself. I'm like, oh, I have been through a lot. But as men, especially in cultures of fighting or cowboys or, you know what I mean? Like, you gotta be tough.
Yeah.
You gotta be strong. You don't let emotions out. And there's something about persevering as a man that's anti having compassion for yourself. Like, oh, I've been through a lot.
Right.
And it's like, no, you grin and bear it. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that's what we've been taught.
And I think too, trauma and pain is relative. Like two people can go through the same trauma and come out with two very different perspectives. There might be people listening that, well, I was never molested. I was never, but I'm dealing with so much. Like,
great point.
I don't have any pain. But like for me, being molested sucked. It was awful. But I would tell you that what was more damaging to me was being left alone in my classrooms. Having my parents, to me, abandoning me. My parents didn't abandon me. My parents are wonderful people.
They are.
But as a young boy, being forced to go to a place that I hated was so traumatizing to me that that really broke me too. And so it's all relative. Like
that's a super good point. It is relative because I don't want anybody to think that you have to be an alcoholic or addicted to porn or be molested or be bullied or like we all have friends that like, I feel like get in this culture and they're like, well, I don't have that big pain, like trauma, childhood stuff. But my dad has never like told me he loved me. Like that's, I'm telling that's so traumatic.
Yes.
As, or my dad left. Like that's even a more common one, right?
In divorce, my dad left or mom died when I was little, whatever.
Any of that.
Yeah.
What the point we're making is we're not minimizing that at all. Like your dad not saying he loved you your whole life is as traumatic as my crap or Mike's crap. Like don't let the narrative of your story be minimized that it wasn't some big traumatic event.
Right.
It could have been small abuses over your whole childhood that shaped the way you think about your dad, that shaped the way that you put your dad's face over what God looks like. Right.
Yeah. You could think of it like this. Like, let's say for me, for instance, I, you know, was molested by my neighbor and it made me believe a lie that I was worthless. And, what we'll just say
perverted gross
all those things, right? Well, let's say, your dad left and you were never molested, but that lie you believed was I'm worthless. I'm not good enough. My dad didn't want to stay.
Don't measure up.
It's the same lie, which causes the same trauma. So it's relative. It just doesn't matter. It's that is unbelievably traumatic to a young person.
Yeah. And I mean, I dealt that with my mom. My mom and dad left.
Yeah.
My mom moved away and I went with my dad. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter the narrative.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter who said what or who fought for who. Like my whole life, I felt abandoned by my mom.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if I just had, if everything in my life was perfect except for that, that's enough. Mm-hmm. That's enough for me to feel unqualified my whole life, especially relationally, right? Like I'm not worthy of a woman's love, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Because my mom wasn't around, you know?
Yeah.
And then all these abuses happened. So again, I think our point is like, I don't want anybody to hear anybody's story on here and feel unqualified to their pain. Mm-hmm. Like it's real.
So real.
Yeah. And don't minimize your own story because it might not be of these bigger, you know, nature of our brokenness and pain.
Right.
So I just say that as encouragement.
And don't logic your way out of it.
That's a, this is I feel huge. Like we could do two hours on that.
We could keep going. Yeah. But real quick, just don't logic your way out of it. You know, thinking like, oh, well, my mom left, but I understand why she did. You as a 40-year-old person understands that. But it's the five-year-old little boy that does not understand that believe those lies that are still in you.
Yep.
That's where pain stems and it's from.
Showing up in your marriage, I showing promise up in your you. Marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I don't feel like I'm cutting this short because you're going to be back.
Yeah.
Often, I believe. I mean, we could pick so many things to talk about that I feel like it's going to be a good offering.
I feel like this was good just to kind of get baseline of my story.
But man, I appreciate your vulnerability and your authentic way of telling your story and sharing and coming on here.
It's an absolute pleasure.
So Mike and Becca have started a nonprofit that from all the things they've learned in their lives, called Soteria. Mm-hmm. So why don't you give that a little plug and how people definitely. Can find you on there, because you guys offer consulting, life consulting and marriage counseling. And, you guys have been through so much. And also you've just, Mary and I and you and Becca have done these courses together and learned a bunch through these LFA classes.
We just have a lot of tools now to kind of help people with this stuff. But my wife and I kind of through all the trauma that we've been through and, the pain that we've gone through, but also the freedom that we've experienced. We just want to give that out. So we started a nonprofit called Soteria Wholeness. It's basically what we desire to do is help people find who they were created to be, to help them through their pain, to help them through their trauma, to help them through limiting beliefs, lies, and areas of their life where they just can't get free. We're really good at helping people understand why they believe what they believe, and then helping them see the truth of who they really are, and then achieving just the best that they can be.
And I can attest to that because we were talking the other day and Mike and I get together and talk frequently about our struggles and the things we're contending for in more areas of freedom. But I've spent over the last year and a half, 2 years, a lot of time with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
She's helped me and I'll get stuck in spots and in my areas of brokenness and stuff. And she really just has such a unique viewpoint into people that I've experienced so much healing and freedom through her.
Definitely.
That, she really is a gift in this area. So I love to send people to her and to you guys because I've just firsthand experienced so much of her insight into my journey. But
So you can find us at soteriawm.com. It's SOTERIAWM.com. Like I said, we provide counseling and consulting. But one of the things I think that we love to do is to set people free. And one of the things that I've learned is when you experience pain, freedom is right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Pain is a good indicator that something's wrong, right? Like you cut your arm, like you don't try and fix your leg, right? Like you go after the cut. And so, when you experience pain, freedom is right around the corner. And so, yeah, if you're feeling some pain, man, give us a call. We'd love to help. But
yeah. So again, Mike will be on more just because I feel like, there's so many different things we can talk about that he's experienced freedom in and he's fought for and we've been through together. So it's pretty cool. And I just want to say thanks to you guys for listening and I don't know, sharing this podcast because I don't have a platform at all. And the responses we're getting back from people really liking it. I just really appreciate it's encouraging to be vulnerable and put yourself out there because you know my journey with this podcast. Like, I really don't know what I'm doing.
Right.
And to get it published and do all that by myself has been a challenge, to say the least. But it's been really encouraging to hear back from people that I know and don't know that are getting something out of it. So I just wanted to say I appreciate, you know, you guys who are listening and sharing it because somebody's sharing it because it's not coming. People are hearing it in random places and all over. So I just wanted to say I appreciate it. And also, Wild Courage, we do have a website. It's thewildcourage.life. That we'll have our events and our Wild Courage Nights is up there. And then obviously the podcast. And then on social media, we have Facebook and Instagram, The Wild Courage. You can check us out there, which is where we post stuff about our Wild Courage Nights that we have twice a month. But anyway, thanks, Mike. Love you, man.
Love you. Thank you so much. It was such an honor.
And until next time.